Hey, it's Jay Young here at the Jay Young Show. I tell you what, I'm really excited today because a lot of people always ask me, so is there a lot of guys like you, Jay, when you know, in cognacs and cigars and cowboy boots and is there like three or four of you that get in a room and you just gouge us gasoline buyers all day long, every day? You just move the price up from $309 to $329 overnight. Who does this? And I mean, I brought an incredible guy in, Jeff Maurer. Jeff is going to explain that it's not us. It's all about supply and demand. How much, you know, supply is out there? Uh-huh. How much is our demand? But Jeff is with the American Oil News. Now, if you're going to talk oil news in America, man, that's the right name of a company, America. And he's been there over 25 years. So, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Jay. So I'm with Platts. I'm the America's Oil News Director for S&P Global Commodity Insights.
Right.
Platts, you know, still exists. It's a long story, but let's just say I'm with Platts.
That's why I said, hey, let's talk about America's Oil News. I like it. So
yeah, no, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yeah, like Platts has been around. It'll give you a little history. Like Platts has been around for, like, you know, 100 years or more. And, you know, it started out as like a one-page, I think I still have a copy of it somewhere, of a really early publication, a one-page publication that said something like, Oklahoma gasoline prices are, you know, or petroleum distillate prices are, you know, 3 cents higher because a wagon broke down. I mean, it was really like that simple. But that's basically what the company's been doing ever since. It's like, not only that, but you know, covering prices, you know, what are prices doing? Not just the sort of, you know, not just the benchmark prices, not just the prices we see on CNBC, which are important, you know, the futures prices, which we also covered, but prices all around the world, right? What are gasoline prices doing in the Group 3 in Oklahoma? You know, what are gasoline prices doing in Chicago or in Northwest Europe, right? And diesel prices and everything. So it's a fascinating a company to work for and a fascinating market to cover because you really see the impact of all sorts of developments, bottlenecks, you know, legislation, what have you, on prices around the world. You know, if a pipeline goes down, as you can imagine, if a pipeline goes down in you know, in the Northeast, that could affect if Colonial Pipeline goes down, that could affect the shipment of gasoline up into the Atlantic coast and cause a big spike in say gasoline prices in the Atlantic coast. So yeah, there are so many players in this market. So you're right. I think it is a few more than four people. Around with cognac and cowboy boots.
How did you get started in this business?
How did I get started? So I had gone to, you know, college many years ago and studied philosophy. And I studied philosophy and a bit of history. And through that, I kind of honed my writing skills, my editing skills. And when I got out, I thought about going to law school. And I worked for a law firm as a paralegal for a couple of years in Washington, D.C. And didn't really like it. It just wasn't for me. But I noticed these publications I were reading, these trade publications. And I thought, you know, maybe I could work for one of these trade publications because I would go out and cover like Nuclear Regulatory Commission of, you know, meetings, and it's kind of reporting, you know, I'd come back and report to the partners, hey, this is what they said. And so, oh, good job. I was like, well, I guess that's kind of what they do. I know it's more than that, but that was a start. And I called around and ended up getting, you know, an interview and kind of came into the company on a very entry level. They wouldn't let me be a reporter yet, but eventually became a reporter and started covering power markets, actually. Like, you know, West Coast power markets, you know, and would cover power price fluctuations because of, you know, let's say there was a drought and you had hydropower, you know, a lack of hydropower, you know, cause prices to rise, all sorts of situations like that. And then I moved to New York shortly after that to cover oil. You know, I saw an opening on the oil desk to cover oil futures. And I moved here, that was probably 20, 25 years ago, I want to say. And they just stayed and moved around in a couple jobs while I was here, and eventually became the director of America's Oil News. For a while, I I kind of had my well, I don't want to say it's my toe in a couple of different streams or whatever. I'm familiar with prices. You know, I would do price assessments, like some of these prices we're talking about. That was years ago. So I have experience doing that. I have more experience on the market side in a way. And then I really wanted to get more experience on the news side. And I shifted over to news later on in my career.
So what's the biggest thing that you've ever, what's the biggest, if somebody asks you at a dinner, what do you do? Or what's the most important thing you've learned? Or what's the most interesting thing you learned about being in this business for so long? What do you think is the biggest takeaway?
I think it's the complexity of it. I think it's that so many moving parts that you're always learning something new. And what I find fascinating is that over the years, it's gotten, I don't want to say it's gotten more complex, but our knowledge has gotten deeper of the industry and what moves prices. So in a way, it feels like it's gotten more complex, if that makes sense.
Is that based on, you mean the world oil and gas production? We need 100 million barrels a day in the world, and the amount of oil that we produce in the United States compared to what we consume? I mean, is that what you're talking about, or is it?
No, I think you start getting into more details from a pricing point of view on things like, you know, product specifications. What type of refined, what type of gasoline are you talking about? You start getting more specific, like the industry, or at least, you know, how we cover it, we just get more and more specific. So, you know, at first you're covering something at a slightly more, what's the word I'm thinking, like a higher level view, maybe the coverage is a little more higher level. But then as you progress, you start digging deeper into, I'll just give you an example, you know, break evens or whatever, you know, like. And as our company has grown and we've brought in more analysts, you know, we have a huge analytics division, and you start talking to the analysts and realizing like all the sort of nitty gritty details that they look at on a daily basis. And that's when you start sort of understanding it in a deeper way, and also realizing how much more there is to understand. I mean, it's like it's humbling, really. You start to realize like, oh wow, like you've barely scratched the surface sometimes.
Well, what's an analyst going to do in your case? What are they going to study? What are they going to look at? They read all day? And
yeah, it depends on the analyst. So you have some analysts that are just geopolitical experts. They're going to, you know, theorize or write about, you know, what's Russia's, you know, policy, or what's the U.S., you know, better one, what's, you know, U.S. policy right now on, you know, foreign policy and how that affects, you know, oil production, or how that affects refined products, or how it affects, you know, any other energy source. And you could have people that are looking, you know, more specifically at trade flows, you know, all this crude and products that are shipped around the world every day, right, on tankers. And, you know, how have the sanctions on Russia and the price caps, how has that affected trade flows, you know, and tracking that sort of data. So you really end up, yeah, with a lot more specialization. I guess that's what I'm getting down to. You get a lot more specialization, but then that makes it more interesting for us on the news team, because we have access to that. And it's not just us, it's other, you know, reporters around the world, our competitors and agencies, but you just get more insight into it.
So what are the biggest challenges that you face reporting on global oil markets? What are the biggest challenges?
Here's a challenge right now we're having, right? There's a, you know, a concern right now with some people that, you know, is U.S. production, how fast is U.S. production growing, right? What are the bottlenecks right now with U.S. production? You know, what are the Permian Basin is still expected to be the only, you know, major source of growth for U.S. production. We had this Willow project, you know, the ConocoPhillips Willow project, which was approved recently in Alaska. And that's more of a, you know, there's a lot of political attention paid to that, which I understand,
oh my goodness,
environmental issues, but that's like 200,000 barrels a day. And, you know, that's pretty much down the road. Like if everything works out for ConocoPhillips, I think we're talking 2029, they'll have that production up and running. But in the meantime, you've got production growing in the Permian. That's the major, you know, sort of basin, right? But there are questions there. Like you know, I don't know if you, the Dallas Fed recently came out with a report where they were, you know, quoting people in the industry who were saying, we can't get people here to work. We have a serious, you know, there's serious sort of inflationary aspects, right? You've had companies, you know, boosting CapEx, you know, lately, but mostly for inflationary reasons because of the cost of production has risen. And so you have people coming out in the Dallas Fed saying, you know, there's a real shift going on here. There's, you know, a lot of people left during COVID, a lot of oil workers left. They didn't want to come back. And then you have a new generation of people, younger people who are like, yeah, you know, I want a better work-life balance. You know, I don't want to be out there. And maybe they don't feel as encouraged because of the energy transition too. They're thinking, well, why would I want to get out there? You know, why would I want to get into the oil industry? Because if I don't think it's going to last that long, what impact does that have? Because there is this internal debate where it's like, you know, I think our analytics folks are looking at Permian production rising to, I want to say around 7.6 or 7.8 million barrels a day by the end of 2026, which is a pretty big hike, you know, from I think 5.6 barrels. But there are other people who say, well, hold on now. Like, you know, you have these companies coming out saying, you know, we're going to rein in that sort of, you know, output growth. We're not going to go, you know, fall out in boosting production. You know, we're more concerned about shareholder, you know, return to shareholders and things like that. The sort of commercial reasons why they wouldn't want to really drive output higher.
Wow, they're really saying that. They're really saying that they're trying to get the Permian Basin to 7.6 million barrels. I wonder how many wells you'd have to drill. How many rigs would you need? How many wells would you have to drill? Because every well declines the first day, right? And then you have a huge decline ratio or decline, but you also have to put so many more wells online. I don't know how they would. I don't know. I mean, that's a huge number. 40% increase in what you have right now. So you would have to really increase your rig count and production.
And rigs have been, you know, kind of flat lately. I mean, they're up on the year. They've rebounded from that COVID level, but they've been kind of flat lately. And, you know, I mean, granted, like the EIA the other day put out they updated their production figure for January. I want to say it to something like 12.5 million barrels a day, which is a pretty big hike. That's total U.S. production. So, you know, we could see U.S. production rise 500,000 barrels a day or 1 million barrels a day. But, yeah, that's one question we have. Like, well, there's like recently OPEC and, you know, its allies came out. That was really big in the news. They came out and said, hey, we're going to cut production, voluntarily cut production by 1.6 million barrels a day to lift prices. They were concerned about, you know, forward demand and the impact on prices. And you know, one of the questions we had was, and I realize it's a very short term thing and producers they're not going to make decisions like sort of knee jerk decisions. But if OPEC's going to come in and sort of, you know, boost that price if you can count on them to come in and cut production and boost that price, you know, at what point do more producers come out and say, hey, well, I want to take advantage of this $80 crude? And how many of those, you know, how many of the smaller producers, you know, the producers that come out and make public statements, they tend to be the bigger ones, you know, the Occidentals and Exxons and whatnot. But like, what about all these, you know, smaller producers, right? Like, what are they doing?
Right.
Like they're the ones you might see growth, growing production from. But it's, you know, and how does that feed into, how does that production growth, it's become such a politically hot topic with the Biden administration and with energy security issues and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and to see the supply balance between, you know, supply and demand. I mean, what is your long term look on the demand for oil? What do you think? Do you think it's going to rise, fall? What's your overall 10 year picture on demand?
This year it's fairly balanced from what I've seen. The last thing I saw, I don't want to quote any statistics because I don't want to get it wrong, but it was like fairly balanced this year, but I do think, again, like our analytics folks, analytics department. I think they were looking at I'm going to say 2.3 million barrels a day growth this year, a global oil demand growth, with like 1.6 coming from Asia, and half of that coming from China. And a lot of that, that's a really important thing. That's something everyone's watching right now. China coming out of, coming out of the coronavirus lockdowns. What does that mean for China's oil demand growth? And a lot of that growth is expected to come from aviation. So that's something that the whole market's just keeping an eye on. And that, again, that's a fascinating thing. Just talking to analysts and people in the industry every day is like, every data point, right? That it feels like for months before before the OPEC cuts and before the banking crisis, before that, it was this constant interplay between China demand and what's the Fed going to do? Is the Fed going to boost interest rates and slow the economy down? And on the other hand, is China going to come back and boost production? And really, it's funny because OPEC, when they boosted, when OPEC said they were going to cut production, they mentioned market volatility. Well, we have this market volatility. Actually, the front month NYMEX crude was really range bound between, between like mid-November and the banking crisis. And I know they're referring to the price volatility following the banking crisis, because that really really pushed oil prices lower because of concerns of a recession. Move back up when they made those cuts.
Yeah. Who is OPEC? Is how many different countries are, why is there OPEC? Because there's who makes up OPEC?
Oh, well, Saudi Arabia is the biggest, the biggest OPEC member. And then you've got, Kuwait, you've got the UAE, and then you have several others, but Saudi Arabia is the biggest in the sense that they produce the most and they have the most, they have the ability to adjust their production. They can cut 500,000 barrels a day or add 500,000 to a degree, but they have they're more able than say other members of OPEC. But then you have allies, and one of the allies is Russia. They had formed this agreement years ago. So they, they have this ability to come in and, boost production or raise production, and that can move prices around. That too creates some political heat. There have been proposals, in the past, and occasionally they get revisited, like with the current production cut, the so-called NOPEC bill. There's been the NOPEC bill floated around where it would allow OPEC to be sort of sued in court for market manipulation, but right. It's never really gone anywhere.
Right. And these countries, what countries in the world do not produce enough oil for their own usage?
Oh, many, like so many. Japan, there's so many countries. So there's so many countries that depend on, imports, that depend on crude imports or refined products imports. The United States is a big exporter, not only of crude now, that's one thing to keep in mind too. We're not just producing crude for our own refineries, we're exporting record levels of crude. I think we reached the record 5.6 million barrels a day recently of crude, and we export a lot of refined products to, especially to Latin America. And that's really important when you consider the sort of, shift in trade flows that occurred after these sort of, sanctions took place on Russia, or price caps were placed on Russian crude and refined products. And that's something, again, kind of going back to this Permian production growth, that's something where there are midstream companies down the Gulf that are really looking at expanding that export capacity. So they want it to grow. These companies like Enbridge and Enterprise and a few others, there's a few kind of pending projects down there, but they have an eye on growing production and growing crude exports.
Okay, but what? How much do we consume a day in the United States? What is our demand, I guess? Or
we produce around 12.5 million barrels a day, and we consume around 16 million barrels a day. Right now, you know, refining capacity is higher than that, but most recently, refiners are consuming around 16 million barrels a day.
So we're still in a deficit.
Oh, yeah.
So we're in a deficit, but we're exporting crude. Why are we
exporting? Yeah, we export, but we also import crude, too.
Okay, so we import, we have to import a lot.
Yeah, we do. We still import about 6 million barrels a day.
Well, I was going to say, if we're producing 12.5 and exporting 5.5, that's net 7. Uh-huh. And if we need 16 or whatever million, that means we got to import a lot. But
yeah,
different types of crude.
But we get there's different types of crude, and we get a lot of crude from Canada. So we get around 3.5 million barrels a day from Canada, and that's a heavier crude. And a lot of refineries in the Midwest and the Gulf Coast are kind of geared up to run this heavier crude. And mm-hmm. Those crudes compete with crudes from Mexico, and used to compete with crudes from Venezuela. But we are seeing a little bit of Venezuelan crude re-enter the market just because there's been some loosening of sanctions there. But that's a couple cargoes here and there a month. But yeah, that's interesting too. That Canadian crude has actually helped the U.S. become more independent. If you think of North America, North American independence, that's been a really important supply of crude for U.S. refiners, and it's really reduced. We used to import a lot more, say, Saudi crude into the Midwest. It would come up a pipeline into the Midwest, but they don't really bring Saudi crude up in anymore. They don't need to. They have all that Canadian crude.
Right. Well, from my understanding too, we're importing a lot of Russian crude, which is the same type of crude that we're getting from Canada, Russian crude, Canadian crude. But then that pipeline, that Keystone pipeline, really would have helped that the Biden administration cut off at the very beginning of his administration.
Yeah.
That would have really helped, because pipelines are so much better and easier to transport than having trucks. On the roads and tearing up roads, it would have been a lot easier to have pipelines.
Yeah, the Biden administration's in a bit of a bind, I think. I mean, not I don't want to over dramatize it, but they released all this SPR crude recently, like 180 million barrels of SPR crude, record release of crude from our strategic inventories to help lower prices, like lower gasoline prices, right? But they have an election coming up. He's up for re-election in 2024. I'm just interested, how much more can they do? Like they're not going to refill that crude anytime soon. Maybe later this year they might start, but they're sort of looking for a price level that would work for them. But I think, and they're not saying this, but I think they would be concerned that if they started buying a bunch of crude, like they would have to announce it. They would have to come out and say, we're going to buy a bunch of crude for the SPR. It would jack the price up jack up the price of gasoline.
I hope they do.
For sure
buy, you do. Buy all you want at 80 bucks. Well, that's one thing that Trump talked about. He said, I was filling the SPR up to the brim at $20, $30 a barrel. And unfortunately, Biden released all those barrels before the last election in 2022. And then he's going to buy it back at $80 or $100. So we just don't have the crude. Nobody's sitting on this much crude. And it was definitely an anomaly of how Trump could have bought all that crude at that time, because, who would have known the coronavirus and prices went to negative and the whole supply and demand thing there. But
I agree, it was a really good opportunity. I mean, it was shot down because it was seen as a handout to the oil industry, but it's like that was a really good opportunity to buy a lot of crude and fill that thing up.
Yeah, but I think that Biden's, I wish he'd buy it, obviously, because we're in the oil business, but also I think he's going to say that, why do we need it? We still have 300 million barrels, and if we ever go into a war, we're not going to need it. So I think it's just I don't think he'll do it, but I don't know. I don't understand a lot of things he does. So he'll probably do it. If I say he probably won't, he probably will. Right.
Yeah. I have that problem too. Whenever I'm asked to forecast a price, I don't really do forecasting, by the way, but everyone asks my opinion. Oh, I think crude will be range bound. The next day it jumps $3. I'm like, yeah, I get it.
Well, like you said, it's so complicated and there's so many different variables and it's so sensitive to anything that can happen. The price can go up and down. I mean, just slightly because of no data or a lot of data. And it's like if you have a coronavirus, I mean, everybody that puts so much information and the thousands and millions of analysts and everybody trying to predict the price and the everything, and all of a sudden you have a coronavirus, which I know is not going to happen very often, but the price went negative. Literally,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that went, one went day, negative. Yeah. That was interesting. Yeah.
I was interviewing my preacher, and I looked at the screen. I caught the screen by chance, and I saw that there was a negative number in front of the price. and I didn't say a cuss word because I was interviewing my preacher, but I almost did. I was like,
"What?
Holy!" You know, I had a beat moment pretty much on that one because I couldn't believe the price went negative.
It was wild. Someone was caught not knowing they had to deliver crude. I remember it was very close to an expiration. The contract was about to expire, the NYMEX contract, and the contract is deliverable at Cushing, Oklahoma, and space was running short.
Bam.
Cushing, and someone was calling the wrong end of that, and yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, definitely the wrong end of that. That's crazy. So let me ask you this. What about, I was reading an article the other day about the fans. They're putting a lot of fans in for carbon monoxide. Let's not go there. What's the new, what do you think about alternative energy? Let's just kind of get an overall view of your thoughts about alternative energy and what's going to happen there? Battery operated cars, that whole thing that people say. Biden says we have 10 years left, I think. Yeah. What are your thoughts about alternative energies?
Well, I think oil's going to be here for a while. I don't think it'll shrink as far as the percentage of, you know, what we use it for, right? Or the percentage of the total energy uses, right? I think oil will shrink, but I think it's going to be here for a while because I think it's just going to take a long time to, and that's something that's come up in a lot of conferences. We were at this, covering this big CERAWeek conference with all these, you know, industry executives, and that's all they talked about, right? It was not all they talked about, but mostly what they were really focused on was the energy transition and how it's very hard to kind of leapfrog. And a really terrific, someone who's written about this is a person named Vaclav Smil, S-M-I-L, who's a professor up in Manitoba. And he's written some really good books on that. One of them is just a history of energy use. And it's I like it because it's very sort of non-political. It just sort of discusses, well, how did we shift human beings from one energy source to another, from, you know, muscle power to animals to coal to, you know. And his argument is like, you can't really leapfrog it. You always need the current energy source to generate the next energy source. How are you going to mine all these precious metals, right? How much diesel is it going to take to, you know, mine all the copper you need and so on and so forth? I don't know if, you know, as far as electric powered vehicles, I don't know what the technology is for that kind of construction equipment, how you would go about doing that. But so I don't really have a projection myself. I think we're, you know, obviously moving in that direction. And I see the advantage of having an electric vehicle. I could see why people shift to them. Although some people, even, you know, people I know who are much, well, I guess, greener than I am, even they're a little hesitant. They're like, well, it's pretty high price right now. I'll wait for the price to come down, you know, but at some point it'll make more sense. A lot of it's like charging stations, right? I'm sure you know people with electric vehicles, right? But they probably, I'm guessing they have homes where they can recharge them more easily. You know, living in New York, it's tough. Like, you know, we have a car. We're about, you know, and occasionally we have parking. But like, we don't have access to plugs.
Right.
Can't really plug it in and so on and so forth. But I think on the, you know, energy transition front, one big thing to watch is the carbon capture projects. Right now, it's still, you know, still just sort of being discussed more, you know, it's an idea more than something has come to fruition, but there's a lot of projects, you know, being talked about where you would be able to, you know, pull carbon out of the atmosphere, and store it, you know, under the ground. Right. And I know, you know, ExxonMobil a while back and announced a big project, for the Gulf, for the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, but I'm not sure what the status is, on that project.
Right. Right.
But the criticism of that is, you know, some people, environmentalists will say, well, hey, they're just doing that so they can keep oil production going. But then the counter argument to that would be, well, if you can remove the carbon, you know, if you really are, you know, if you're actually removing the carbon and you're not just issuing carbon credits based on, hey, we're going to plant more trees, you know, isn't that a more sort of practical approach? You know, one that would actually have more direct results, you know, than the sort of credit approach.
Right, right. Well, and I guess the big, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about when you were saying that was about the carbon copy is basically, you know, with oil and gas, I mean, we're not necessarily, it's not like every bit of oil that comes out of the ground goes into your gasoline or, you know, plane strength and automobiles. I mean, it's only a small percentage of that because there's so many other products that are made out of oil. Other than just, you know, and if you took away all the cars, you still have, and I think it's 50 to 60%, or it's like half the barrel of oil is for cars and cars only, or cars and vehicles and cars are 20-30%. So it's only like, even if you took every car and literally plugged it in tomorrow, you would still need a lot of oil in the United States, you know, because we're still growing. And
no, I get your point. Like, I think the current yield, like when you think of, you know, how much refined products does a barrel of crude produce, like I think it's something like 55% currently goes to gasoline, 30 something, I'm probably getting it wrong, I apologize. I always keep these numbers straight in my head. 35% for distillates, diesel, stuff like that. You know, that's largely industrial use and trucking. But then you've got jet fuel to worry about. And now there are big pushes to create like a sustainable jet fuel, a sustainable aviation fuel, and that's supposed to climb going forward. Biodiesel is supposed to climb going forward. But that's still an issue. I think that there's been some really interesting articles out recently on battery-powered airplanes, right? Like, I forget the companies, but there are companies that have been able to make, like, you know, electric airplanes, but they're able to carry three people, maybe a couple people.
Right.
Beyond a certain point, you're putting in larger batteries to carry the battery, you know, because of the weight of the battery. Like, you can't get that up to a commercial, you know, 737 or whatever.
What's amazing, I mean, we're going to see the Jetsons. I mean, me and you are old enough to think about it and remember the Jetsons, but man, it's really crazy that there's that many. But I believe that, I think the biggest takeaways here for the show is, hey, you know what? We're still going to use a tremendous amount of oil in the future, whether it's going to be for the demand. You know, wells decline in production, especially in the Permian Basin. They may decline 40, 50, 60% the first year. So it will take a lot of oil and a lot of drilling to keep that number up there to 5.5 million or even grow it to 7.6. I can't imagine how many wells that you would have to drill to increase production 40% in the next, you know, would you say 5 years, 6 years? I mean, that's going to be a lot. We're open for it. We're open for it. But I don't think the capital's there anyway. But I think that's big because, you know, even with a lot of alternative energies that are coming in today, you know, we're gonna think about, you know, hey, there's still a lot of oil that's going to be needed. Natural gas is something that we really didn't touch on, but you know, we do import natural gas, and we're going to import more as soon as we get the Freeport. As soon as Freeport opens up, pretty soon, I hope that's worth a billion and a half, I believe.
Yeah, you've got that petrochemical demand to worry about, right? When you talk about that, like as far as what we use petroleum for too, right? All the plastics.
Right.
It's a lot.
It's amazing. It really is. I mean, where's that Super Bowl commercial from Energy Transfer? It talks about, well, not just the Super Bowl commercial, but Energy Transfer has commercials out about, you know, petroleum products and like, well, this microphone and this, you know, all the different things on my computer screen and the computer and all these different, everything is, it seems like it's made from oil. So there is a big demand there. So, I'm excited. Well, Jeff, how do you want to finish up, or how do you want to summarize this time together? What's the big thought? Something that you've been thinking about?
I would say just, you know, keep, when you think of, you know, shifts in gasoline prices, and it's very easy. I understand it. No, I don't think anyone really likes, no offense to the two refiners and the oil industry, no one really likes pumping gasoline into their car. No one shows up and is like, all right, this is fun. You know, everyone likes spending their money on more interesting things. And a lot of people things are tight. You know, inflation's high. Like, I don't want to downplay the consequences of high gasoline prices on people's budgets. And you know, it's tough out there, right? So, but to keep in mind that there are a lot of forces that move these prices. It's such a huge market. It's a global market. And that, you know, something that happens halfway around the world can affect the price of gasoline, you know, in the United States. For instance, refinery strikes in France. You know, just recently there were these big refinery strikes in France that removed something like 700,000 barrels a day of refining capacity for a while offline. And that affected not some, you know, gasoline, but mostly diesel. That was a big deal. It really helped boost diesel prices for a while.
Yeah. And also, too, the European countries needed natural gas. They're paying $15 to $20 an MCF, and we're producing it over here at $2.
Yep.
Well, we that's a huge deficit. We could have made it, but we couldn't send it over fast enough, or we didn't have the freeport or the other ways to do it. But if we could have, that would have increased the price of natural gas here sky high, and so we're not able to make that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's enough paper, and I don't know, a lot of people don't use paper anymore, but I don't think there's enough paper notes to think about the reasons why oil and gas can go down in a day, a week. Just imagine how many different things that could affect the price. It's truly amazing. Truly amazing. What an incredible market. Yeah. Every day is a different day. I mean, that's what you could probably say to yourself is, every day is a different day.
Oh, definitely. It's amazing. It really is. I mean, there are some days where it's like, oh, it's feeling a little repetitive. That lasts for 5 days, maybe 2 days. doesn't last that long.
Hey, great. Well, Jeff Maurer, I tell you what, you've been incredible. I really do appreciate your insight. I mean, when you have somebody on the inside that has the knowledge, it helps me learn more about what I need to know about making decisions going forward. And you're right all the time, you know, but you can just take in as much information as you can over time and use that information, because you never know. I mean, literally things can change, you know, overnight. So,
yeah. Well, thank you, Jay. I really appreciate it. I really, really, thanks for having me on. It was great.
Absolutely. Jeff, and I'll tell you what, next time I'm in New York, I'm definitely going to look you up, and let's have breakfast or lunch or something. Love to pick your brain some more about it and keep in touch.
Cool. All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you have any more comments, or if you have any more suggestions on who to have on the Jay Young Show, click below, reply back, and remember to subscribe, number one. But number two is also write me back and tell me who you want to have on the show. Thanks very much. Thanks, everybody. See you here next week.